While social networks may be the watering holes of the internet, scientists and mathematicians are using the collective power of people to solve problems, make discoveries. This hour, imagining a world, a new era of network science made possible by the web. What problems would you like it to tackle? Plus, could embryonic stem cell therapy finally be showing signs of success? We'll look at one study that helped people see again, but is the study too short-sighted? And the earliest known evidence of dog domestication, a 33,000-year-old wolf fossil found in a Siberian cave. What does it tell us about your pet pooch and its ancestors? Some answers and your questions after the break, so stay with us. Science is now sexy. Science has become the theme of TV shows and Broadway plays, film and artwork. And we think it's a real trend, and we've created a whole science and arts section right on our website, entertaining interviews with artists and actors, scientists and celebrities. It's the only one of its kind, and I invite you to check it out at sciencefriday.com/arts. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. Stem cell therapy, it seems, is always promising to cure diseases or illnesses. And this week, a study using embryonic stem cells has increased the hope of fulfilling some of those promises. Researchers say results of an early clinical trial indicate it may be possible to restore vision using embryonic stem cells as treatment. It was published in The Lancet. Human embryonic stem cells were used to treat macular degeneration in 2 legally blind patients. 4 months after the transplants, researchers say the therapy appears to be safe and has even improved the patient's vision. The study was the first published report of the use of embryonic stem cells in humans. It comes over a decade after these cells were first isolated in the lab. Dr. Robert Lanza is the chief scientific officer of the biotech firm Advanced Cell Technology, which funded the research. Dr. Lanza was also co-author of the Lancet study. He joins us from Marlborough, Massachusetts. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. A great pleasure.
What was the purpose of this trial using embryonic stem cells?
Well, we were studying the safety and tolerability of the cells. One of the trials was designed to treat patients who have Stargardt's disease, which is the most common pediatric macular degeneration. And the second trial was to treat patients who have dry AMD, which is the leading cause of blindness in the developed world. And in both studies, we turned the embryonic stem cells into cells known as retinal pigment epithelium, or RPE cells. And those were injected under the retina into the subretinal space of the patients. And these RPE cells are responsible for maintaining the health of the photoreceptors, which we see with. So in both of these degenerative eye diseases, which are currently untreatable, there's a loss of these RPE cells, which leads to a loss of the photoreceptors and then blindness. So we are hoping that by adding new healthy RPE cells, we might be able to prevent this process from occurring.
Was this sort of a proof of concept stage?
Well, actually, this is a phase 1/2 study, so it was essentially just to test the safety of the cells.
Right.
We were actually going in these first 2 patients with the lowest possible dose. These, again, are patients with very advanced stage disease, so we weren't expecting to see any real efficacy at this early point.
And you did find, at least in one of the patients, provability that something was happening.
Absolutely. You know, it's first important to point out that when you measure visual improvements in patients with low vision, this is very difficult. There's no consensus, in part because of there's currently no treatments. But that being said, the vision in both patients appears to have improved after transplantation of the cells, again, even at the lowest dose. So before treatment, the Stargardt's patient could only detect hand motions. But within a week after treatment, she was able to actually start counting fingers. Indeed, before the treatment, she couldn't read any letters on the standard visual acuity chart, but by 2 weeks she started reading letters, and by 1 month she could actually read 5 letters. But I think it's important to point out that that doesn't really capture the difference that this makes in their life. So for instance, the Stargardt's patient reports she can now see more color, and she's a graphic artist, so of course that's very important to her. She had better contrast and dark adaptation out of the operated eye. For instance, the dry AMD patient can now use her computer again. She can even read her watch. So little things like that, which we all take for granted, obviously can make a huge difference in the quality of a person's life.
You've got to agree that 2 patients is hardly enough for a larger conclusion.
Absolutely. It's very important to point out that there could also be a placebo component to this improvement. But I think there's enough objective data to suggest that there's a very real biological signal. And these are obviously very preliminary data, so we need to interpret the results very cautiously until we have more data and in more patients.
Are there more patients in trials?
Yes. So we have two clinical trials. The first for Stargardt's involves 12 patients. In the second study, the dry AMD, is another 12 patients. And just recently, last Friday, we started a new study in Europe, the first in Europe, where we started treating another group of 12 patients who have Stargardt's disease.
Now, is this true that this is the first use of human embryonic stem cells in patients?
Well, no. There have been three trials that have been approved by the FDA. One was Geron for spinal cord injuries. They have halted that study, and then these two studies. So these are actually the first published results that are indicating what we might expect to see.
And you bring up a good point. If Geron is now out of the human embryonic stem cell business. Right.
From what we can understand from public statements, they didn't see any biological effect, which, of course, makes it difficult to have a therapy. So, again, they were early-stage trials as well.
So that, like, puts it on your back, does it not, to continue?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, for 13 years, everyone's been talking about embryonic stem cells, and so they're saying, well, does it work? Does it work? So I think this is the very first time that we have some signals that something's very real seems to be happening.
Could you actually see a regrowing of the damaged area?
Yes, this is a very interesting thing. When you treat the eye, you can actually look into the eye and see what's going on in real time. So we can actually see with very high resolution instruments right down to the cellular level. And we could actually see, beginning at the first week, an increase in the pigmentation that continued throughout the study period. And we also had these OCT, these high resolution instruments that showed engraftment of the cells in spots where there weren't any cells prior to the treatment.
Now, I understand that actually, if the cells were just sitting in a petri dish in the lab, you can watch them grow right there.
Yeah, it's very interesting, yes. And in a petri dish, it turns out that these embryonic stem cells like to do all the tricks and make all the cell types that are in the eye. So in addition to seeing, for instance, these retinal pigment epithelium, we also can see photoreceptors and the various neuronal cells, the bipolar cells. So they almost want to assemble into an eye in the petri dish.
And so how do you keep them from assembling into other things besides the eye once you put them into someone's eye?
Exactly. So that's why this has taken so long to get into the clinic, at least in part. So when they're left on their own, these embryonic stem cells will turn into a hodgepodge of cell types. So in one part of the dish, you might see cartilage or nerve cell, and then in another section, some beating heart cells. So the main issue is how to turn those reliably into the desired replacement cell type. And in fact, we're still just learning how to do that with some cell types. But fortuitously, it turns out that these cells like to become retinal pigment epithelium. So you, in almost all these cultures, they will eventually have little freckles of pigmentation, which are RPE cells, and those cells expand very, very nicely. So we can take very small patches and turn them into literally millions of these cells.
And you took these from embryonic stem cells.
So we actually started out with a single cell from a leftover IVF embryo, and we turned that cell into an embryonic stem cell line, which, of course, are the body's master cells, so they can become virtually every cell type in the body. And since these cells are immortal, they can provide an unlimited supply of starting material. So for these studies, we turned those stem cells into these RPE cells, which were then frozen down, then shipped off to the clinical site, and then after they're reformulated, they can then be injected to a fine cannula into the subretinal space of the patient, and actually it's an outpatient procedure.
Is it true that you have pioneered a way of getting the embryonic stem cells out of the embryo without destroying the embryo?
Yes. I mean, obviously, there are some people, such as former President Bush, who think it's wrong to, quote-unquote, destroy one life to save another. So we developed another method that's routinely used in IVF clinics around the world, known as PGD. And this method allows you to remove one cell from an embryo without destroying it. And then we take that cell, instead of using it for genetic testing, we turn it into stem cells. And we now have several of these lines that we can use in the future where no embryos were destroyed.
How many cells do you have to inject into the eye to get it?
So in these clinical trials, there are dose escalation studies. So in the first three patients of each trial, we will start with only 50,000 cells. And then after we treat those three patients, we will double the dosage to 100,000 cells, and then eventually 150, and then finally 200,000 cells. So that's not very many cells.
And why has it taken over a decade for a published report on such a use of...
Right. Well, embryonic stem cells are amongst the most complex biological entities that have ever been proposed for clinical use. So the dynamic complexity of their biology poses regulatory concerns, in particular, for instance, teratoma formation, which by definition, these undifferentiated cells have to do if they're injected into a living animal.
Mm-hmm. Advanced cell technology, and you personally have been criticized in the past for overstating results. Because you've been having trouble raising money to stay in business. How do you answer those critics?
Well, there are a lot of forces working against us that will turn things any way they can. We try to be as clear as we can. We try to publish in peer-reviewed journals and try to present the data as clearly as we can. We are a public company, so obviously that impacts stock, but it just doesn't make sense not to just to present the data as straightforwardly as possible.
And why is the eye a good spot to try to do this now?
Well, actually, there are three reasons. The first reason is that there are diseases that affect millions of people. So dry AMD, for instance, affects 30 million people worldwide. It's currently untreatable. There are no therapies. It's a horrific disease. So if we can do something about it, that's important. Two is the eye is what's known as immune privileged, which is one of the very few sites in the body where you can actually transplant cells without a risk of rejection, or at least the rejection process is reduced. And then thirdly, it turns out that these embryonic stem cells, as I mentioned earlier, like to turn into what's known as neural ectoderm, into neurons and these retinal cells, so that we can actually get these cells in very large numbers. And in fact, we can get near 100% pure retinal cells, which is very important, of course, going into a patient.
All right. So what do we tell all the people who are listening now who want to get in on a study because they know somebody or themselves suffering from some eye illness?
Be patient. We're working on this as aggressively as we can. It's very important first to show that these are safe. We do no harm first. So far, knock on wood, things are looking very good. And if that pans out for the rest of these studies, we will then be able to increase into phase 3 and 4, where we'll be able to treat hundreds and then eventually thousands of patients and then get more reliable data. Then it can become more wide-scale, assuming everything goes as we all hope.
I want to thank you very much for taking time to be with us today. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Dr. Robert Lanza is the Chief Scientific Officer of the biotech firm Advanced Cell Technology, which funded the research reported in the journal Lancet. He's also co-author of the Lancet study there, and he was joining us from Marlborough, Massachusetts. Hi, SciFry fans. There's a new app in town. If you're listening to this on our SciFry iPhone or iPad app, there's a newer, better app waiting for you to download on iTunes, the SciFry Booster Edition. It's loaded with new features like playlists, Twitter, Facebook, and other goodies. It's optimized for your iPad. The videos look terrific. An Android app is in the works, too, so please be patient. For you iOS fans, just go to the iTunes Store and search for the SciFry BE app. That's the SciFry BE app. Download and enjoy. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Chances are you've come across the website Wikipedia in your daily online searches. It's a free encyclopedia that anyone can edit, and it certainly has a wealth of information on everything from the Australian cattle dog to Lady Gaga. Now imagine a Wikipedia for science, a place where scientists and others can go to research topics outside their area of expertise. Find links to cutting-edge studies, edit, update content. Surprisingly, it's not a new idea, but efforts to create a Wikipedia devoted to science has failed in the past. In fact, scientists as a group, they don't seem to have embraced online tools to collaborate and do science out in the open. Why, you ask? Well, that is the subject of my next guest's book, Dr. Michael Nielsen. He is a physicist and author of the book Reinventing Discovery, The New Era of Networked Science. And he joins us from Toronto, Canada. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much, Ira.
Why are scientists the last ones to get in on this?
Well, it's kind of funny. I mean, they certainly helped bring us the web back in the early 90s. Unfortunately, they're pretty bought into doing things in the standard way, the way they've done them for centuries, which is you do your work in the lab, you get all your results, you write them up in a paper, and possibly several years later, it all appears for your colleagues to digest at that point. And you know, that's a great system if you're back in the 16 or 1700s, but today we've got better tools, but people still haven't adopted them.
And these are collaborative tools, then?
Yeah, I mean, you can talk about sort of people collaborating together, sharing knowledge, maybe attacking problems out in the open, where you can bring in lots of different expertise from all over the world to maybe get a better handle on some of these problems.
Give us a flavor of how that might work. You have a couple examples. We have many examples in your book, but...
Sure. So an example I really like a lot that kind of illustrates how different this is over the past couple of years, a group of mathematicians, starting with a Cambridge mathematician, a fellow named Tim Gowers, have started what they call the Polymath Project. And what they've been doing is using blogs and a wiki to attack difficult open research problems completely in the open, allowing anybody to contribute basically by posting their ideas in the comments section of these blogs and the wiki. And they've actually been really tremendously successful at attacking some of these problems.
So they're sort of crowdsourcing the idea and waiting for people to help them find a solution.
That's pretty much exactly what it is, yeah.
How far can you apply this to other, let's say, disciplines outside of mathematics?
Well, you know, to some extent, it's an open question because not everybody's doing it. And so it's going to be really interesting to see. There have been, you know, all kinds of efforts in different fields, astronomy, genetics, and many others, which have been at least sometimes very successful. But it's still very early days, and mm-hmm. I think it remains to be seen just how far we'll get.
Well, we have a lot of people interested in science who listen to us. Maybe they'll call in or send us some ideas. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry. Talking with Michael Nielsen, author of Reinventing Discovery, The New Era of Network Science. Maybe you would like to use networked science. You have an idea. Maybe you have used it and make some suggestions how it might work for you. Is there a wiki? I mean, is the wiki for science the central place for people to go, or can they go to other kinds of groups that they might find more attractive?
Well, it's funny, actually. It's kind of a... In some ways, it's a bit of a sad story. A lot of scientists have tried starting wikis for science. One I happen to be very familiar with is a quantum computing wiki. That's my area of research. And while a lot of people, researchers in the field, were very excited by the idea of having the quantum computing wiki, certainly many I spoke to, that didn't necessarily mean they wanted to take the time themselves to go and contribute. And so you have this funny situation where a lot of people think a resource would be really useful, but they're too busy doing other things, working on their papers and their grants, to want to contribute.
You called it a quickie, right? Instead
of that was actually their name was quickie for quantum wiki.
That's good. But it didn't get traction, is what you're saying.
No, it didn't get traction. And to be honest, I thought it was actually really well executed. So it's not like it failed because it wasn't well done. I think it failed because people lacked the motivation to contribute.
Well, one of the major obstacles to open science, you say, is scientists being rewarded for publishing scientific papers. How do you change that culture?
Yeah, so, I mean, I should say, first of all, that it's a terrific thing that they get rewarded. If you go back to the 17th century, scientists generally weren't rewarded much at all for sharing discoveries, and as a result, they conducted a lot of their research very, very secretively indeed. So, you know, it's a good thing that we have this modern system, but we would like to change, I would certainly like to see a change to a new system where scientists are rewarded for sharing their ideas more broadly, for sharing data more broadly, and for sharing their computer code more broadly. Mm. Now, you can get into how to do that. There's a lot of details. It's a complex question.
Yeah, let's go to Joe in Whitehall, Virginia. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, how are you?
Doing great. Listen, tell me, you're making it sound like a new concept, but isn't this the whole reason the internet came to be, that it evolved from ARPANET back in the late 60s and early 70s? You're making it sound like a new thing.
Sure. You're absolutely right that if you go back to 1970 or so, at that stage, it was really almost a scientific research project, and it gradually grew through the 70s and 80s, mostly in academic institutions. But I think what we've seen through the 1990s and the 2000s is that, in fact, the rest of our culture has caught up to the scientists and actually gone really a long way past them. Things like the success of Wikipedia or the success of open source software like Linux really have eclipsed in how they're using these tools the way scientists are using them. And so there's some catch up for the scientific community to do at this point.
Ah, so there is. Well put.
All right. Thanks for calling, Joe.
Yes, sir.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if we can get another phone call from Mitch in Park Rapids, Minnesota. Hi, Mitch.
Hi, how's everybody doing?
Hi there.
This fits well, because my point was about my understanding of scientific discovery and research and development is that it's funded by private businesses mostly, and so it's for profit. And so if I'm a business owner and I'm going to put $10 million into a new way to put stem cells in somebody's eye or, you know, whatever. I'm not going to want to share that with somebody because I'm doing that for my own profit. And so you need to have that network of millions of people, as Linux does, who are willing to put in their own time for the common good and the culture of computer and technology is not the same as the culture of scientists. And so it's going to take time until that culture of research shifts to the open, the openness of the technology industry.
Yeah, well, people willing to work for nothing.
Okay, so let me come back on, you said that you started by saying that most research is funded by companies, but actually about $100 billion a year is spent of just public money on basic research. That's a lot of money, obviously. I mean, it's an absolutely astounding number of dollars to be spending on basic research. And that money, presumably, is being spent in the public interest. And so I think you can make a pretty good case that publicly funded science should be open science. Now, you can shift from that kind of basic public research to focus on more applied commercial research, as you suggest as well. And so you might say, well, what happens there? And actually, what happens there is kind of interesting. To some extent, I agree with you. There will continue to be a secretive culture within many companies. But there are some big companies, Eli Lilly is one, for example, who are interested in what they call open innovation models, wherein they actually give up some knowledge about their internal processes and their internal problems, and they try and recruit people from outside the company to help attack those problems. So even some, what you might think, traditionally very secretive organizations are actually finding some benefits.
Mm-hmm. When you have an open society, you allow anybody to come in and take a look and, I guess, in a way, become a peer reviewer, right? I mean, won't peer review change if billions of people are allowed to look at the work and comment on it?
It's a really interesting thought. You know, again, I think it's early days, but there are some interesting examples. I guess last year there was a lot of talk about this so-called Arsenic Life publication. So some people found that maybe arsenic was being put into the DNA in living organisms, and there was a paper published in Science that got a huge amount of publicity. And actually, some online bloggers started to look in detail at this, particularly a person named Rosie Redfield, and they started to pull apart the paper with a lot of help from the community and comments from many, many different people. And I think it's fair to say that maybe that work has resulted in a lot of skepticism now about arsenic life.
1-800-989-8255. Some examples that I can think of where I think gets across the idea of scientists, of citizen scientists. We've had examples. We've had people on the program who talked about, you know, crowdsourcing gene folding, right? People can see patterns better than computers. They can figure out maybe how gene molecules protein molecules fold a little bit better. There's something you talk about in your book called the Galaxy Zoo. I remember we talked about that also.
Oh, right. So this is the where they're crowdsourcing galaxy classifications, yes. That project you're talking about.
Yes.
Yeah. So what do you want to know, Ira?
No, I'm just saying that is this the kind of public science that you're talking about, getting people involved who may not be scientists, maybe citizen scientists, to help out scientists in their own projects?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there in Galaxy Zoo's case, they recruited 250,000 people who actually did, get this, 150 million galaxy classifications, which enables the astronomers who started the project to solve all kinds of interesting astronomical problems that they couldn't do otherwise. You can't, as a scientist, sit down and do 150 million classifications at your desk. It would just take too long.
Mm-hmm. Is it? Do you find that that there is resistance to changing the way, the old way of things being done? Are older scientists resistant to change and becoming part of this process?
I'm not so sure. I'd say resistance so much as it's just difficult to see how to cause a large scale change. How do you get everybody simultaneously to adopt a new way of doing things? And so some people will kind of throw up their hands and say, well, it just can't be done. Probably the people I actually get that the most from are scientists who are sort of in their mid-career. They're doing postdocs or they're at the end of their graduate studies. And while they're subject to the system, they don't really feel like there's very much they can do to change it. Mm-hmm. When I talk to younger scientists, they're often very enthusiastic. And sometimes when I talk to much more senior scientists, because they feel like they have some power to actually change the system,
right.
They can actually be quite enthusiastic.
Talking with Michael Neilson, author of Reinventing Discovery, The New Era of Networked Science, on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flato. Let's go to the phone lines to David in Rochester, New York. Hi, David.
Hi. I think I have a good example of this with amateur archaeologists in North America. And years ago, I was interested in the archaeology of Western New York here and started noticing these stone structures in the woods. And there was some local information that it was Native American. And with the birth of the Internet, all these people started to blog about how they were finding these things in the woods. And now there's a connection with all these amateur archaeologists, and the professional archaeologists are beginning to look into this. It's interesting how we all share this information, and it's grown.
Interesting. Michael?
Yeah, that's a terrific example. It's not one I'd heard of, actually, before. I guess in my book I talk a little bit about some amateur birders who are doing some very similar kinds of things, and they use the Internet to keep in touch with one another and to keep track of what rare bird species they've seen nearby. So it's kind of a parallel example, I guess. There's a lot of sort of similarities in how they're doing that.
Is there any fear here with being overwhelmed with participants and people who may not be as knowledgeable and having to weed through all that stuff that comes in?
Sure. So there are certainly some difficulties and challenges that arise. If you create – any time you open up your system of producing information some more, you create, I guess, more potential for noise as well as signal. And so that's a serious point. And we're still discovering what that's going to mean. There have been some interesting examples of scientists making public announcements of potential discoveries on their blog. One blogger, for example, announced rumors that the Higgs boson had been found.
I remember that one.
And then, it was a guy named Tomás Rodrigo, and he kind of had to walk it back a few days later, but it wasn't until after The New Scientist had published kind of his rumors, basically. And that's an unfortunate situation, and it is a bit of a problem.
Mm-hmm. Last question in the last minute I have. If the open science model is adopted, you say it will be the second time the process of scientific discovery changed in history. What would be the first one?
Yeah, so I guess I talk about the first and second open science revolutions.
Yeah.
And so the first is going back to the 17th century. In the very early days of science, you had people like Galileo often very reluctant to share their discoveries with the world. And it really was the adoption of the journal system, in fact, at the end of the 17th century, that started to see scientists be a bit more forthcoming. And that was a wonderful thing, and it's, you know, just magnificent for our society that that happened. But today we can do better. We have better tools for working together, better tools for constructing knowledge together. And so we need a second open science revolution that will see scientists and the public more broadly adopt those tools and use them really to their full potential.
And you think this is going to be a hugely powerful event?
I do. I think, you know, when you look at the history of science, it's tempting to focus on big kind of scientific discoveries, the invention of the laser or, you know, the structure of DNA or things like that. But when you're actually talking about the tools which people use to construct knowledge itself, like when you change those, that's incredibly powerful. It's a bit like what happened when the internal combustion engine was invented to transport. Mm. All of a sudden, you just completely change the game across the board. And I think we're in that same kind of a transition, but not for transport, but rather for how we construct knowledge.
If you want to know more about it, you can read Michael Nielsen's new book, Reinventing Discovery, The New Era of Networked Science. Thank you for taking time to be with us today, Michael.
Thank you so much, Ira.
Good luck to you. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the earliest known evidence of dog domestication. Stay with us. You hear me on the air every week, but do you know what it's like inside our studios? Yeah, you can check out pictures from the studio every Friday at our Facebook page, facebook.com/scifry. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Ever wonder where your pet poodle or your Labrador came from, who her ancestors were, and when she evolved from wolf to dog? A 33,000-year-old fossil discovered in a Siberian cave may help shed some light on those questions. Researchers report that features of the ancient skull, including its overall size and teeth, indicate it might have belonged to a wolf on the way to becoming a dog. They say the skull tells a story that may make us question everything we thought we knew about dog ancestry and domestication. Dr. Susan Crockford is an evolutionary biologist and adjunct professor at the University of Victoria. She co-authored the study on the skull published in the Public Library of Science. She joins us from British Columbia in Canada. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello.
That's a pretty big claim to question everything we knew about dog ancestry and domestication.
I'm not sure that's exactly what we said, but it certainly does shed some new light on some of what we've been thinking about what's been going on.
Now tell us about, give us a little nutshell description of what you found.
Well, it's a complete skull with both of the lower jaws. Most of the teeth are there. The skull was found in a cave in Siberia in the Altai Mountains in about 1975. The Altai Mountains are in sort of southern Siberia. If you look on a map, it's where the confluence of Mongolia, Siberia, and Afghanistan, just to sort of place it. And the original archaeologists who found the specimen thought that it really didn't look like a typical wolf. And so he pulled it out for some reanalysis. And that's what we've been doing now, is going back and did some radiocarbon dating to put it in proper chronological context, and also looked at measuring it and that sort of thing to see how it compared to both more recent dogs and also to wolves of that time period.
Well, what would be the key differences and the key similarities to make it look like it was transitioning from a wolf to a dog?
Well, the really key outstanding feature is its size. It's about the size of a large Samoyed dog, so really quite small for a wolf. However, the teeth are still wolf size. So it's this combination of dog and wolf features that makes it different.
So you've pushed this fossil back over 30,000 years. What was the last fossil estimate of that timeline?
Well, in around 12 to 14,000.
Wow, that's a big difference.
Yeah, it is a big difference. And one of the things that really is critical, we think, is that one of the things that happened in between that, of course, was the Ice Age.
Oh.
And so a lot of places where some of the other fossils have been found in Europe actually were covered in glaciers during that Ice Age period.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really important blockage,
yeah,
of things going on in Europe. And one of the things that we noticed was that while this specimen was found before the Ice Age, there are no specimens similar to it that continue on through the Ice Age period or after in that same area of Siberia. That area of Siberia actually wasn't covered by glaciers, and so people still live there, and even still, there are no similar specimens that carry on through time.
Mm-hmm. And so is there still this big gap between 12,000 and 33,000 years of knowledge of what happened there?
Yes. There are several more specimens similar to this one that we found that were found in Belgium, the Czech Republic, and around the Caucasus in southern Europe, and that are similar to these and about the same from the same time period, but still this big gap.
Yeah. You know, we've been told over the years that the common belief about how dogs were domesticated is that ancient peoples tamed wolf pups through they tamed them and created them, brought them in, and they morphed into dogs, so to speak. Does this back that up, or is there a better theory?
Well, I would say not. One of the things that has come to light is that that idea that taming actually leads to the changes we see between wolves and dogs really has no evidence to back it up. It doesn't mean that it couldn't have happened.
Mm-hmm.
It just means that really there is no evidence to suppose that that's true. So what anthropologists and biologists have been looking at is what kind of process might be a better explanation for how that transition would have occurred. And what we're coming up with is the idea that actually the wolves domesticated themselves, that when people settled down into permanent villages, that some wolves chose to come and live with those people, and as a result of that colonization of the new habitat, that they naturally became this new species that we call a dog.
Now, why would it have to become a new species? Why can't a wolf just, you know, learn to live with people if that's what it did?
Well, partly because of its own natural inclination to stay away from dangerous predators.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you have to remember that that's what people were at that point in time. They were hunters, and they were hunting big game animals like mammoths and horses and bison, and they were actually in direct competition with the wolves of that time period. And wolves almost certainly would have challenged people, tried to come and claim a carcass of a mammoth for themselves, and people would have had to drive them off, and they would have killed them, I'm sure, if they could have.
So to live peacefully with people, the wolf would have to become more peaceful, is what you're saying.
Well, I mean, peaceful is one way to put it, and the other some of the other aspects that need to change in terms of behavior,
yeah,
are the fearfulness, and the stress response. They need to not run from people when they get close, because it's actually getting close to people means that they can go in and scavenge some of the waste that is laying around.
Mm-hmm. And as far as the skull getting smaller?
Well, what we know from experimental evidence is that some of these kinds of changes are the result of growth rates shifting between the wolf and the dog. And that almost certainly happens while the while the puppies are still embryos, so while they're still inside the mother, they're being exposed, or they're growing at a slightly different rate than the wolf ancestor is.
Mm-hmm. So we find evidence that they have evolved before the last ice age. We have this big ice age, this giant gap in history, and now do they have to then be domesticated all over again?
Well, and that's what it looks like, is that this, whatever the process that's going on, is it was happening from Western Europe all the way across to Siberia before the Ice Age. The Ice Age put an end to that because people had to move away and start doing different things. After the Ice Age ended, people settled down again, and the process started up. So it means that whatever this specimen was, if it was maybe in the first few generations on the way to becoming a dog, it didn't make it all the way. And it certainly is not an ancestor of modern dogs.
It's not.
No.
Can we get any DNA samples out of these things?
Possibly.
Yeah.
That's one of the areas of further research that we're going to try and get into.
And where would you look for more fossils? That would be those missing years here.
Well, we would need to look in an area of Eurasia that wasn't covered in glaciers during the Ice Age.
And are there people?
And so that pretty much puts us into, say, southern or most of Siberia, actually, and China. China's a very fertile area, actually, possibly specimens showing up there. There hasn't been a lot of work done, and there's a very good chance that there could be some quite old early dogs showing up in China.
Mm-hmm. If wolves were evolving to become more domestic, were there other animal relationships evolving with humans at the same time?
At the same time as dogs?
Yes.
No, not really. It really seems to have been pretty much sequential, especially in those early days. And so the next one after the dog, a little bit of contention there, but it looks like perhaps the pig.
Uh-huh.
And then goats and sheep.
When did the house cat come into?
Oh, it's quite late. It's it doesn't come in until around the Egyptian period, maybe 4,000 to 5,000 years ago. So and it again, if you think about even the way cats were used or the way that they were living even 50 years ago in rural areas, that they were being attracted by the rodents that were living off the grain, stored grain. And so that brought cats in from the wild.
Did they look different than they would have today?
Not very much. Cats actually haven't changed as much from their wild ancestors as dogs have. And that has to do with this business of how the growth rate changes and how it changes the length of the snout. A wolf has a much larger snout than a cat does. So there's more room for change.
Very interesting. Let's go to the phones. Elle in Los Gatos, California. Hi, Elle.
Ellie, yes. I feel that that wolves, it's all through food and need. In the dead of winter, when food is scarce, the wolves need food, and the people thousands of years ago were more in tune with nature and would put food out for them. And little by little, they became more gentle and docile because they trusted. There was a mutual trust. Hmm. And I've seen this in today with friends who have put cat food out for wild skunks and wild raccoons. And over the years, with many generations, these animals have become quite domesticated and quite happy in their homes. So it's always a need. It's a mutual need that I feel really is how it comes about.
All right, Ellie, thank you for calling. 1-800-989-8255 is a number. This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flato, talking with Dr. Susan Crockford. What do you think of that? Do you think that might be a mechanism?
Well, she raises an interesting point, and that is that there really has to be some kind of need on the part of the wolves. And one of the things that I think it comes into play here is that there may have been instances, especially after the Ice Age, where wolves may have been stressed. They might have had some food shortages going on, in which case it would have made all of the waste products that people just left lying around. I mean, they didn't have to put it out for them especially. It was just there. And that would have been especially attractive. So it really raises a point that it was beneficial for both. The wolves got to eat, and the people got to have their campsites and their villages cleaned up.
Let's go to Dustin in San Antonio, Texas. Hi, Dustin.
Hi, how are you today?
Hi there.
Thank you. As I understand it, wolves and dogs can successfully interbreed and produce multi-generational successful offspring. Are they still considered different species? And if so, isn't that a bit arbitrary considering the differences seem to be mostly phenotypic? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Good question. Dr. Crockford?
Well, that's an issue that has been contentious for a little while. And part of that comes from the idea that animals cannot interbreed if they are indeed true species. They can't interbreed and produce fertile offspring that go on to breed for another generation. And one of the things that genetics has shown us is that very many more real species can hybridize than we have ever been aware of. And what's important to keep in mind is that while interbreeding is possible, it doesn't happen on a regular basis. And so at that level, it really doesn't challenge or put in jeopardy the species as a whole.
Mm-hmm. So we're changing our views then about how this might have
been. Well, I think so. And it one of the things that's happening is that one of the arguments is that wolves and dogs are very close genetically, and so perhaps we should actually consider them just the same species but a different form, a different subspecies perhaps. But in fact, what we're learning is that there are very many species who are just as close genetically, and we would not consider them to be members of the same species. So it really is putting some more emphasis, I think, back on the differences in form, the body form, and the behavior and the physiology, and those differences between them that keep them separated, and that is raising in importance. The genetics, not so much.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Crockford, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
It's been a pleasure.
Have a good weekend. Dr. Susan Crockford is an evolutionary biologist and adjunct professor at the University of Victoria in Canada. She co-authored the study on the skull, published in the Public Library of Science. Our program's senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Intagliata and Alessia Bayak. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Our intern is Francie Deep. Neil Rausch is our technical director and at the controls here in New York. I'm Ira Flato. Thanks for listening.